We're broadcasting.
Great. Do we need to pause while we let anybody into the room? Any guests? No. Okay. Then I will go ahead and call the meeting to order. And if we could do a quick roll call, Stephanie, please.
Sure. Emeryville?
Here.
Alameda County?
Here.
Berkeley?
Here.
Hayward?
Here.
Thank you. You have a quorum.
Outstanding. Thank you. And so public comments is next. This is an option for anyone who wants to speak on an item that is not on the agenda. Please raise your hand to do so.
I have Chuck, Roselle, Jessica Thawad, and Blair Beekman.
Okay, I see Blair's hand is up, so it looks like he's ready.
Okay, Blair's unmuted.
And if you would unmute your own phone, Blair.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Great. Can I be third? I need to get a little bit more ready first for public comment.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Yep, I see Jessica's ready, so can we unmute her?
Yes. Okay, Jessica, you're unmuted.
Hi, everyone. Jessica from East Bay Clean Power Alliance. And I wanted to make a couple comments, just logistical stuff from the end of, public participation. First and foremost, and I have shared this with Stephanie, but that whomever is working on the new website, whenever there's a meeting that starts, like the last board meeting, as soon as that meeting starts, the information, the sign up, the Zoom link, all disappears. And what shows up is the information for the next meeting. So this meeting showed up. So for people who might be joining a board meeting late, they don't have access to the information to join the meeting. So that's something that should be remediated pretty quickly. I guess how the working before was working better on the website. And then the second thing is we don't have access anymore to the Zoom recordings of previous meetings, love the board meeting, audio from the CAC. And that kind of stuff is important for people who cannot attend meetings for whatever reason, be at work or other meetings going on. So I think the access of the means is to the information and being able to see the slideshows later on, that kind of thing is really important for public participation. And I think now more than ever, when one of the most controversial issues of nuclear is being considered in East Bay Community Energy through Brilliant 100. So for that, I think there's some attention needs to be put there so that the public has the information that they need to access to make the best possible decisions and participation on these issues. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Al, you're muted.
Thanks, Jesse. And thank you, Jessica, for bringing that to our attention. Can I get someone from staff to just acknowledge and reassure us that that's going to get worked out?
Yes, that is actually something that's currently on a priority for the marketing team, is to address that with our consultant. They have been
fantastic.
Made aware of this.
Great, thank you. Hopefully in time for the next meeting. Okay, so next speaker. So Blair's the only one with a hand up, so I hope you're ready.
I'm ready. Thank you.
Great. Go for it.
Yeah, thanks. I hope these words can be applicable to public comment. We're all considering how to end Diablo Canyon in the next 3 years. Of course, in 5 years' time, small nuclear power startups should be starting to make headway and should be part of our consciousness more in our everyday lives. And of course, the goal of EBC Energy should be taking steps to completely end purchasing nuclear power altogether in 5 years' time. A simple 2% decrease over the next 10 years would be a 20% decrease of nuclear overall by the EBCE. This would cover a lot. I hope we can organize simple ways to chart these sort of steps openly and publicly over the next 10 years. For all of the nuclear energy help with carbon issues, the mining, the possibility of accidents, the after waste of nuclear power, all of its costs, and its overall theories and study practices are simply being understood as not very sustainable human practices. Thank you. I learned a lot from the BOD meeting of last Wednesday. There was an issue that because of your new website, you're having trouble placing your video minutes on the agenda. You nicely worked out the issue so I could at least listen to the audio minutes yesterday, and it was really helpful. And you know, good luck how you work out that issue. I don't know what can be done for it, and good luck with that. There was an issue I had with the CAC. I didn't want to make a big deal about it, and I'm sorry to bring it up publicly, but they don't have a public comment process for its meeting minutes approval each time. And I'm wondering, is part of the Brown Act to allow meeting minutes, a public comment to be allowed for meeting minutes? Is that part of the Brown Act? And, you know, I hope you can work out those procedural questions, and hopefully we can talk about it and write each other sometime later. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Blair. Are there any other public comments? I don't see any hands. Oh, I do see that Dan Kalb has joined us. Looks like he needs to be promoted to...
I've just promoted him.
Thank you. So anyone else wanting to speak in public comments, please raise your hand or we'll move on. I don't see anyone else. Stephanie, do you?
I do not, no.
Okay, then I will go ahead and close public comments. Thank you to the speakers. The next item is approval of the minutes from June 26th. Any corrections that need to be made? Anyone want to speak on the item?
So moved.
Second.
All right, moved by Director Haggerty, seconded by Director Arreguin. A roll call vote, please. Stephanie?
Okay. Emeryville?
I'm sorry, point of order. Should we take public comment?
Well, I did rather quickly there. I invited public comment and nobody raised
it. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed
yeah.
it.
Perfectly then, fine to catch me on that. I do forget it sometimes.
I apologize. Aye.
Thank you. Oakland?
Aye.
Alameda County?
Yes.
Berkeley?
Aye.
Hayward?
Yes.
Thank you. Motion passes.
Yeah, it passes unanimously. Thank you. Okay, so moving on to the regulatory and legislative update. This is an informational item. We're going to be receiving an update on the regulatory and legislative matters. And am I turning this over to Melissa or to Nick?
It's Melissa.
Melissa, yep.
Fantastic, Ms. Brandt.
Okay, so I'm going to first go through an update on the regulatory proceedings, and then we will cover the legislative and end of legislative session update as well. Next slide, please. Okay, so I'm going to talk about, I'm sorry, Stephanie, can you go one back? Thank you. I'm going to talk about the PG&E Oakland Clean Energy Initiative's application proceeding, PG&E regionalization application, resource adequacy, and the PG&E ERA account. PG&E's Clean Energy, Oakland Clean Energy Initiative, they filed the application, as you're aware, and we've been going through the process to get PG&E approval for its part of the deal. And as you may recall, our part of the deal going through is contingent on their part getting approved by the CPUC. So there were settlement conferences held on, Okay, there were settlement conferences held on September 1st and September 8th. And there's a status conference next week with the administrative law judge and all of the parties to decide whether hearings are needed. One of the issues that's come up in the proceeding is a dispute between PG&E and Alameda Municipal Power about it's a FERC dispute about the operating agreement between those two entities and whether that needs to be amended in order to enable the broader initiative to go forward. That dispute has been brought into the CPUC proceeding, and it's still a little bit unclear at this stage whether the administrative law judge will continue to consider that an issue in scope or will allow FERC to settle that issue. The challenge with FERC settling the issue, however, is that it may take a lot of time. And so we are very much needing these contracts to be approved so that the projects can be built and online when we need them for reliability purposes and for resource adequacy. And so we are actively engaged with the different parties in the proceeding to try to continue to push for a speedy approval. And we're looking at partnerships that we've had with other entities, including Sierra Club and the Energy Storage Association as well, to see how we can continue to support this application. PG&E filed its regionalization application this summer, and they are seeking to open essentially regional offices throughout their service territory. And they've broken it into different regions. Most of EBCE would be in the Bay Area region, and the city of Tracy would be in PG&E's Central Valley region. So we'd be spanning two different regions. It's a little bit unclear how this would affect our operations with PG&E. And so that's one of the questions we've had so far. We attended a pre-hearing conference to discuss what's going to be in scope in the application. And we are still awaiting action by the administrative law judge on next steps, including the schedule, as well as which issues are in scope. And we are expecting that PG&E will probably be required to file an update to their plan later this fall, and then go through a kind of a proceeding process with the other parties and perhaps make some changes to that plan accordingly. The original plan they filed, it was done so quickly that there wasn't really enough detail there to know how concerned we are about this. We initially touched bases with city staff to see if any of the cities were concerned about what was being proposed. But as we get more details from PG&E, we're going to need to continue to renew that dialogue to make sure that the way they're setting up their regions is not going to have a negative impact. Particularly when we're talking about emergency operations and PSPS type events. So that's something we're monitoring very closely. I actually have more slides on RA and ERA, so why don't we go to those, please? Okay, so RA, we were dealing with implementation on the one hand and then some new policy issues on the other. First, for implementation, as you may recall, the CPUC passed a decision that creates a central buyer for the local resource adequacy that we have been required to buy. So in a couple of years, the central buyer will be buying all of that instead of us buying our portion of that. And so there was an issue that we had brought up, which is what happens when an entity like EBCE has already invested in local RA resources. How can we make sure that we get compensation for those? And so the decision set up a working group process for parties to come together and try to work out a compensation mechanism. So we participated in that with CalCCA, and CalCCA and EBCE were really leading that process and helping to develop that mechanism. And we've actually gotten some good consensus on much of that design from the other parties to the proceeding. So we have filed a report, which is kind of the next steps in the process with the PUC, and we're expecting a proposed decision now from an administrative law judge, hopefully endorsing that compensation mechanism. We are also continuing to work with the CPC to figure out how can we provide value to EBCE's customers when we actually avoid local RA costs or avoid the need for local RA because of our investments in load reducing distributed energy resources. So some of the investments that we are making that align with our broader EBCE goals actually reduce the need for local RA. And under the CPUC central buyer system, all customers in PG&E's service territory would benefit from our investments. So we're trying to work through to make sure that if our customers are paying for these investments we're making in the DERs, that they're also the ones reaping the benefits, the full benefits of those investments. And there's a workshop on the 6th of October to further discuss these kinds of issues. Next slide, please. So I mentioned that part of it was implementation and the other part of RA is the program structural change. RA has been a challenged proceeding for quite some time and has not been working well for a number of reasons. Prices have gone up, yet we've also had the recent blackouts. So, you know, things aren't working as well as we would like to see. So we've been proposing some structural changes and refinements to the program, and including looking at some issues that were just never really worked through in the previous RA proceeding. And we actually worked with Southern California Edison and through CalCCA. So we had the CCAs and one of the major utilities coming together and submitting a joint draft proposal on 8-7. And so we're working through that process with the CPUC. The Energy Division had their own proposals as well, which I think we prefer our proposal. We think that that's better for long-term stability and cost. But now we're going through the CPUC's process of discussing the merits of the different proposals and figuring out what the final structural changes will be. So certainly the recent blackouts are going to continue to shape the discussion and everybody's impressions of the problem. And then final proposals they were originally due on the 15th of October, but I think that I saw a ruling yesterday that actually pushes that out perhaps by another month. So our team is very actively engaged in these discussions and trying to come up with a solution that's going to help make this program more stable in years to come. Okay, next slide, please. So I also wanted to just update you quickly on PG&E's ERA proceedings. As you may recall, there's the forecast proceeding that looks forward and determines the PCIA as well as the PG&E bundle customer rate. And then there's the compliance proceeding that looks back to see if PG&E's accounting was essentially correct for what it charged in PCIA. So I think the key message is in the 2019 compliance proceeding, we've had some significant reductions to PG&E's actuals. So that's good. It means we're paying less or we'll see refunds. And I think in this case, we actually have already gotten PG&E to agree to a $132 million reduction from their original ask. And we're still disputing over $33 million. And then in the forecast proceeding, what we're trying to bring down the forecast, but ultimately I think there's going to be a big PCIA rate increase in 2021 once again, both because of a forecast increase in costs, but also because the utility is going to start collecting the excess funds that it has not collected in 2020 because of the cap. And so that's just going to make 2021 once again a very challenging year from a PCIA perspective. This problem is really not going to go away unless and until the PCIA is kind of structurally changed. So so that's kind of where we're at with ERA. I don't think I have anything more on that one.
So before you, are you done with the regulatory update before we jump into the legislative ones?
Yes.
Yeah. So let me just pause and see if there are any committee members who want to comment on the regulatory component before we jump into the legislative. Go ahead, Director Martinez.
Thank you. I just have a few questions. The first is, what time is it where you are, Melissa?
9:21.
Well, I just want to just take a point of personal privilege and say I'm really grateful that we're able to retain you and you can still work on all of these issues from Germany.
So, hi,
You're really missing out on the heat storms and the smoke. But so the questions I have for OCEI, you talked about whether an issue would stay with the CPUC or go to FERC. And I'm wondering how long could this process extend if it did go that route with FERC?
So AMP has filed they filed a complaint at FERC. So it will go through the FERC process. I think the question is whether it also slows down the CPUC approval process. The FERC process can take a long time, and we don't really have an estimate, but it could be a year. CAISO wasn't really willing to give us any sense of their expectations on timing. Okay. So one way to think about it is we were really seeking CPUC approval of the deal, of the PG&E deal, by the end of 2020. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the FERC complaint works its way out, that doesn't necessarily have to impact these projects getting built, because right. they're taking issue just more generally with PG&E's, you know, operations. Mm-hmm. But if it gets pulled into the CPUC proceeding and becomes a reason not to approve the contracts, then it could delay the contract start dates or even the viability of the projects.
Okay, I hope you will keep us apprised, because I'm sure you're aware, even from Germany, that the governor has stated that there are no combustion engines are gonna be sold in the state of California by 2035. So the pressure, you know, even more than legislatively, it's coming down from on high, is getting greater. My next question was regarding the central buyer implementation. Outside of the issue of being compensated for the investments that we've already made, once this process is all, you know, is fully functional, I'm hoping that this was done to get ratepayers a savings. In the end, is there any analysis on whether rates will actually be affected by this?
I don't know that ratepayers will get savings from this. I think that this was largely the CPUC's idea that if they had a central buyer, that the central buyer would be able to buy everything that's needed in a way that they felt that a more disaggregated market couldn't quite do.
So is it more for efficiency with the process than ultimately for the price?
So you're asking the question of whether this change will actually be helpful or
yes.
good.
Yes.
I don't know that our position would be that it is.
Okay, I hope so.
We've made that argument for years. Yeah.
I hope so. That's that. Okay, thank you. Those are my questions.
Great. Thank you, Director Martinez. Any other committee members want to comment at this point? Don't see any electronic hands going up. So Melissa, why don't you go ahead with the legislative update, and we will get to public comments and another round of committee comments at the end of that.
Okay, great. So as I think everybody is aware, COVID-19 dominated the leg session this year. It really just completely changed what we were expecting out of this leg cycle. We had some interesting bills in the works, other folks did too, and all of that, for the most part, went away because of COVID. So the legislature was out for significant chunks of time due to COVID. There was a direction for everybody to really slim down their bills, to only push bills forward that really had to do with COVID. Or were otherwise incredibly urgent. So most of the bills just came off the table this year. What I would say that was exciting for us is that we were able to score a major victory in securing a budget allocation of $51 million for the CEC for its CalEVIP transportation electrification infrastructure program. And so this is one that we worked for and that our Alameda County delegation really went to bat for as well. So we had a lot of meetings with our legislators, and they had a lot of meetings with leadership as well as the administration to make sure that this budget item got passed. And so that's really important, because we are a recipient of the Cali VIP grant for 2021. The details of that, of course, are still in the works. Without this funding, it would have been very hard for us to be able to get that budget allocation for ourselves. So that was a big win this year. I would say energy issues remained important throughout the year. Not a big surprise given, you know, PG&E and the finalization of its bankruptcy. Wiener had introduced a bill to take over PG&E, but it failed. Hill's bill, SB 350, was signed into law, and that creates a framework for a state-run backstop entity if PG&E were to fold. So if it hadn't been able to get out of bankruptcy, or if it has any catastrophic events and goes back into bankruptcy, then there is now kind of the framework for creating a state entity to do what PG&E does. Next slide, please. So long duration storage is also another issue that has continued to come up. And we saw two bills that were introduced to enable long duration storage. They both failed. I think the challenge here is that in most cases, the legislation has been favoring a particular project or a particular developer, and tends to be incredibly expensive. So without looking kind of more holistically about how long duration storage fits in, it's been too targeted to certain developers. So that's been one of the challenges with that one. And we've continued to monitor it because we also don't want to be forced to buy into an overly expensive project at the expense of looking at other good options. Central procurement was on the table early on. We had the AB 56 bill, which would have created a central procurement entity sponsored by TURN. And then we had the CalCCA bill, which was the Marzucci bill, that would have also created a central procurement entity, but in a way that ensured that the load serving entities that wanted to do the procurement were doing that procurement first and having the central procurement entity fill in the gaps. We also saw several microgrids bills introduced, which made sense coming out of the wildfires and the PSPS shutoffs from last year, but none of them succeeded, again, just because of COVID. And then we also saw SB 364, the Mitchell bill, pass. And this was a bill introduced to continue to preserve preferential tax treatment for utility scale solar projects should the Prop 15 reform initiative pass this fall. So that went through. And then finally, AB 1941 was introduced to suspend the RPS standards, but it was quickly quashed. There's really no appetite right now, I think, to suspend the environmental goals. So those were some of the highlights. Next slide, please. The Energy Committee oversight hearings, COVID-19 really limited any appetite for oversight hearings, but the Assembly Utilities and Energy is expected to have an oversight hearing in early October to discuss the root cause analysis behind the August rolling blackouts. Might be worth noting that CalCCA put out a letter recommending that, in addition to the analysis that the CPUC, CAISO, and CEC are conducting, to have maybe an independent third party also look at some of the root cause analysis behind those blackouts as well. And then finally, what are we expecting for next session? Bills can be introduced as soon as early December when the new leg session kicks off. And we would expect that many of the bills that were shelved due to COVID will be introduced. So things like long duration storage, PCIA reform, central procurement, central reliability, especially in light of the recent blackouts, we would expect that to be a major focus this year. Possibly distributed generation, microgrids, and Senator Skinner had a distributed system operator bill. So those are some of the options. Next slide, please. And then finally, so the 2020 ledge cycle ended August 31st. September 30th is the last day for the governor to sign or veto bills. And then, as you know, November 3rd is the general election, and December 7th is when the next legislative session begins. And then I just had a few key highlights from some of the bills we were tracking. I already talked about SB 115 budget bill. It was passed and signed by the governor. SB 364, I also talked about with the solar property tax exemption. That was also passed and signed by the governor. AB 1659 did not pass. That would have been extended in a non-bypassable fee on customer bills that goes through 2036. It would have extended it through 2051 to raise $3 billion, but the funds would have been charged to utility customers, and the activities to be funded were really quite a variety, not necessarily energy related. So that one struggled to get much traction. AB 841 did pass, and that supports more investor-owned utility deployment of utility side EV infrastructure. This is one that I think really benefits us as well, because the more investment the utilities make in their side of the infrastructure, the more EV charging stations we can support in our territory. So working with utilities, it really is kind of a win-win when we can work jointly on the transportation electrification efforts. And then finally, in very late stage, there was a gut amend of AB 913. It was amended one day, passed the next. And it enables the investor and utilities to request financing orders for undercollections and bad debt due to COVID. Initially, we were very concerned that the IOUs would be able to access this tool for their generation costs, and that we would be at a competitive disadvantage because we don't have similar financing orders. But the investor and utilities committed that they would only use this on the distribution side of their bills. So there's no more competitive disadvantage. But what I think is really noteworthy is that we had five different senators on the committee voice support for CCAs and a voice interest in knowing that CCA customers would be benefiting in the same way as the bundle customers and not somehow disadvantaged or left behind as this bill got passed. So I think that just speaks to the fact that we've really built a strong coalition with our legislators throughout the state as CCAs, even though we're still fairly new entities. That they're really backing us and expecting us to be able to both help our customers from a rate perspective as well as help meet those environmental goals.
That's progress.
Yeah.
Okay. Done, Melissa? Fantastic. So to my fellow committee members, please raise your electronic hands if you want to comment or ask questions. Not seeing anyone. You get another chance after public comment if you come up with something. So Stephanie, if we could invite public speakers to join in. I see one hand up from Blair Beekman. Anyone else who wants to speak, please raise your hand.
Blair has access to his microphone. You can unmute it. There
we go. Hi.
And we can hear you.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. As you talked about COVID issues, this can be an important time to just really thank yourselves of the East Bay for your work with the state of California on COVID issues. I feel you've created a plan in what we can expect as everyday community over the next few years, like with housing, with transit, and even with EBCE, that has been a lot of comfort to myself. And you've worked out, just really in practical terms. And it's just been an incredible comfort to myself to be able to live in the East Bay and Fremont at this time. I'm originally from San Jose. Their transit agencies, they're having a bit of difficulty with budgeting and financing issues. They just can't speak the language, how to come across with the needs and what exactly is happening at this time. And it's a bit difficult for them. They can learn some important lessons from yourselves. I hope you can be of help. And you know, just make it an open communication, not just for yourselves, but for us as the everyday public to understand what's happening. And, you know, it's no fault of the Santa Clara County, San Jose area, and the VTA. They do eventually come through with good plans for everyone. It just takes them a bit longer, and they're a bit more conservative about it. And I know Ash Kara, as assemblyperson from San Jose, he works well. He's a good go-between, and he can really understand how the East Bay is working, and that's important. So I just wanted to take this time to thank you. I've got a minute 17 left. I suppose this is a time to mention San Jose is working on a little PG&E plan called Hummingbird Energy, I think, and it's how to create storage capacity for solar, I think, in a converted transformer space. I don't quite know the language. The transformer space used to use natural gas, powered by natural gas. I don't know if it's still going to do that. They're working with PG&E on the issue. I thought it was important to mention that. And finally, you were mentioning EOC issues, and that got me thinking about the good work of BayUSI. They're the federal agency that hands out money, and they work on EOC issues and planning. And they're a good agency that is another agency that I feel I should introduce yourselves to understand issues better. They want to address wildfires. They want to address that in human terms and in helpful terms. And it seems that's what you're trying to do with PG&E right now. And we're doing such an important, incredible work as local community energy. I hope PG&E, you know, can really learn the lessons what we can accomplish with local community energy. And BayUSI is working towards those good goals as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Blair. Any other public speakers? Stephanie, I don't see any hands up.
No, but I have Barbara Stebbins listed.
Barbara, if you want to speak on this item, please raise your hand. There we go. You're unmuted. Can't hear you there. There we go.
Yeah, no, I muted and then unmuted again. Sorry.
Go for it.
Actually, I really wasn't intending to speak on this item. So I think I'm just going to let the time go. But we're speaking on the next two items. So.
Okay. We'll come back to you. Thanks, Barbara. And thank you to Blair for your comments about Alameda County handling of COVID. I definitely agree to share those compliments to my fellow council members, and especially to the county. I do feel like we've done a good job with that. So I'm glad others feel the same way. Any other comments on this item from anyone on the committee? Don't see any hands up. All right. Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for staying up so late, apparently, in Germany to give this report. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
All right. Next item on the agenda is the CAC guide and appointment process updates. And this is an action item. So there'll be a staff report. I'm assuming that's going to be handed off to Nick or if not, let me know who for the report. And then we'll have a recommendation, hopefully, that we can coalesce around as a committee.
Yes. Stephanie, can you pull it up, please? Great. Thank you. So, these are a set of updates to the CAC guidelines meant to really kind of address the next round of appointments to the CAC that we have. So currently there are 3 open CAC seats and 2 open alternate seats. So, you know, some appointments need to be made. And one thing that, has sort of consistently been communicated to staff by our board is the importance of having CAC representation from all parts of the service territory. So if you go to the next page, Stephanie, can you go to the next page? You'll actually see, that currently we do not have any CAC representation in the Tri-Valley. And Now, Tracy is not a member of the program, but we do not have any representation from San Joaquin County. So that would be expected given that they haven't joined the program. But, and you know, I think relative to population and the number of customers we serve, we only have one CAC member from the Tri-Cities area. So given the feedback we've consistently heard from the board about the importance of wanting good geographic representation of the CAC, staff has endeavored to make some updates to the appointment guidelines to reflect that. So I'd say the first, and that really gets to sort of the first suggested update, which would be to create sort of five areas, the Northern Alameda County, East Alameda County, South Alameda County, and Central Alameda County, and then San Joaquin County as sort of the fifth area and potentially sort of an emerging part of our service territory. And then allocate the CAC seats to those five zones, roughly representing their share of the JPA vote. So that's what this first table illustrates. So our five northern cities have 36% of the JPA vote share. That roughly translates to three CAC seats. East County has 14% of the JPA vote share. That roughly translates to one CAC seat. South is 27, which translates to two. Central, which we've also included unincorporated Alameda County, recognizing that there obviously are parts of unincorporated Alameda County throughout, but from a customer perspective, it's Castro Valley and Cherryland and San Lorenzo are where you have the most EBC customers who are unincorporated residents. So that was the rationale for having grouping unincorporated in the central zone for a CAC from a CAC seat perspective. And then finally, because Tracy is in San Joaquin and, you know, we do feel, you know, it is, while certainly, you know, there's similarities between Tracy and San Joaquin and the Tri-Valley, it is different. And we felt, and it is also a new participant in the program. And so staff recommends allocating one dedicated CAC seat to Tracy for now, and certainly if service grows further into San Joaquin, that would be covered by this CAC seat. And then, you know, we do have two alternates who we would select from, you know, anywhere in the service territory. So that's the first recommendation. And the second recommendation, really, it's the assignment of these seats geographically. And then the third is related to trying to ensure that we maintain this geographic representation. That is shortening the appointment terms from 4 years. Well, right now, some people have 4-year terms, some people have 2-year terms. Shortening all terms to 2 years, we would maintain the 8-year limit. So today, you have a 2 or 4-year term, but you know the. You can't serve more than 8 years on the CAC, so we're not changing that. The real rationale for going to a 2-year term, though, is we have observed that in some cases, somebody joins the CAC as, say, a Fremont resident, and then they move to Oakland. And so recognizing that can happen, I think if we want to maintain the geographic representation, having a shorter term, we don't want to kick that person off the CAC. They're still contributing. They have, you know, lots of experience that they've gained. And so we want to maintain that continuity. But at the end of that 2-year term, if say they no longer live in the city or where one of the cities in the zone for the seat they're sitting in, then that seat would be open and could be reapportioned to the, to those communities. So that's I think really the long and the short of it.
Okay. So Because this is an action item, I'd kind of like to get public comment, but Scott, you've got your hand up. Do you want to go before or after public comment?
Sorry, I was having a mute problem. I can wait. I was actually going to suggest, because I would like to hear from the public.
Yeah, okay, great. So I don't hear any objections to that. So Stephanie, let's go to public comment speakers. And I see Barbara probably should be first. Yep, and you're unmuted, at least on our end.
So I think our biggest concern recently about the Community Advisory Committee has been, it doesn't seem to be getting a lot of attention from staff or the board in terms of replacement of members. So we're down to 6 members and no alternates at the moment. That's 2 away from not having quorum at any point. And I think that we support the notion of geographic representation. We think that's important, but it certainly isn't the only issue. And I think we, certainly East Bay Clean Power Alliance, is mostly going to push for representation by communities that often their voices are totally left out of kind of public commissions and committees of this kind. So we want to make sure that there is a diversity of representation of, for instance, income levels or racial or ethnic identity. So we just think those are very important things as well. We're slightly concerned that if there isn't a robust outreach during application times, and especially outreach to those communities that might very well be left out, that we will wind up with a community advisory committee that really doesn't represent an awful lot of communities in Alameda County. Because I think every geographic location has communities that have greater needs, especially in terms of equity. So I think that's mostly what I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. Great points. Stephanie, next speaker.
Jada Dumas-Dogan.
Thanks, Stephanie. Hi, this is Jada Dumas-Dogan with East Bay Clean Power Alliance and Local Clean Energy Alliance. My comment is not directly related to the recommended changes, but it's about the process in general. It says in your proposal that the executive committee and or an ad hoc committee of the board will interview enough candidates for the number of available seats and recommend the appointment of members to the full board for approval. I didn't see anything about input from the current community advisory committee in selecting new members to their committee. Is there a specific reason for that? Wouldn't it be helpful to get them involved in this process? That's my first comment. And the second one, it also says in your proposal that EBC will announce the start of the application window via meeting announcements, EBC email distribution list, and the Community Advisory Committee website. This sounds good, but I think you should also consider reaching out to the community organizations in your service area to recruit Community Advisory Committee members. That's related to what Barbara was saying. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next speaker, Stephanie.
Blair Beekman.
Hello.
We can hear you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I'm getting used to just trusting that you can hear me. thank you. I don't want to quite speak to what was the subject of the item today, but I do want to speak to the item, to the issues of the CAC and what I mentioned earlier, and what was actually in this meeting as well. The meeting minutes, when that is approved, I don't know if that is an actual Brown Act, you know, that Brown Act stipulates that you have to have
public comment on the approval of meeting minutes. And
so Blair, let me forgive the interruption, but I would ask that you stick to this particular agenda item for this time period.
Well, it does concern. I first noticed it with the CAC, and I couldn't speak about the meeting agenda minutes of the CAC, and it's for this meeting as well, and it's an issue I can take up in letter writing at another time. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, but thank you for following the agenda. Next speaker.
Cynthia Landry.
Yes, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. Please go ahead.
Oh, great. I'm coming along here with my technology. As you know, I have been on, and I have been very proud to be on the community advisory commission. I guess I've been on the commission, the advisory council now for about four years. And what I wanted to say, a couple of things. One is I do agree with Barbara's comment. In addition to regional diversity, there needs to be diversity of representations in terms of various constituency groups, such as Barbara pointed out, a member from the low-income community, social justice constituency groups, ratepayer, labor, of course, and other groups that were previously outlined in other memos. So I do agree, we do need to reach out regionally, but when we reach out regionally, we need to keep the diversity intact, because we are representing the entire community. In terms of whether the CAC advisory committee should have an input on who's selected, personally, I think that should be left up to the board, and I think it's more neutral, I think, if it comes from the board. And the last thing that I want to say is it's a learning process. I'm a social worker by profession, and it's a learning process. And I think that people that may want to consider remaining on the board maybe could have some priority in terms of the selection process for continuing to serve. Thank you. Those are my comments.
Thank you, Cynthia, and thank you for serving on the committee. Stephanie, do we have any other speakers? I don't see anyone.
No, I do not have any other speakers for this item.
All right. Thank you very much. Then we'll move to committee members. And Director Haggerty, did you want to start us off? Your hand's not up, but you had it up earlier, so I wanted to give you first.
Yeah, I don't know where it went. I didn't take it down. Probably Stephanie didn't want me to speak.
that was me.
On this one, first of all, I think the easy one is, if we're going to have alternates, I think we should have alternates for each of, and I'll refer to them as planning areas, because it would be bad for somebody from, say, Tracy not to show up, and then they're represented by Oakland. That just doesn't work. So I think each planning area should have an alternate that is called if they can't make it in, and then they go to the alternate from that community. I also am, I try not to do this very often, but to me it's kind of glaring that the Tri-Cities only get two people. Fremont's the second largest city in Alameda County. And I really think that, the fact that they're at 27, I really think that they're really close and they should get that extra body that have three people. So, and then I am a little troubled about Dublin only having one, but I guess that can be for the next supervisor to talk about. But I do feel strongly about the other stuff that I talked about.
Okay. Thank you, Director Haggerty. Anyone else? I can't see everyone, so it really helps if you raise your hand electronically.
I raise my hand.
Director Haggerty, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with Supervisor Haggerty about having alternates from each geographic area, just to make sure that those areas are represented if the appointed CSC member is not able to participate. I like the idea of, now that we have new communities that have joined, more communities, having appointments by geographic area. I do think Supervisor Haggerty's point about Fremont is valid. In terms of JPA vote share, I guess, or load share, it's not as much as North, but population-wise, it's certainly greater. But I think that's something for us to consider.
Okay, thank you. Director Martinez.
Thank you. I also agree about the alternates and the representation in case that a member is not present. Although I know it is not easy to fill these seats, it's not easy to get applications, so I just want to give a nod to all of our public speakers who were asking staff to conduct some really robust outreach in our communities, because I agree that we have to get the word out to get folks to understand that this is a consequential board, and we really value these voices. So please let us know as board members what we can do to assist.
Thank you. Director Haggerty again.
Scott, you're muted.
Yeah. Stephanie did it. So when Director Martinez was talking, she reminded me something that I thought about, and I guess I would really say this to Jesse as a member of the Mayor's Conference, but, you know, what if we made these appointments of the Mayor's Conference and the mayors appoint them? It seems like, you know, they can do everything as far as, you know, ethnic groups, they can do everything as far as making sure we have laborers. We've all done when we've sat there and made these appointments, you know, we've gone through all this. But I know at ACTC, their Citizens Advisory Committee has a certain level of Mayor's Conference appointments. I throw that out there for thought to see what people think.
Okay. Thank you, Director Haggerty. Director Kolb.
Thank you. I think the regional question makes sense, and I think our biggest challenge has been just the identification and recruitment of people who are interested, and that will continue to be a challenge. There needs to be somebody's responsibility, and then they need to spend time to fulfill that responsibility, and part of that time is to interact with the various board members and alternates on the board to make sure that we all go out and help with the outreach and the recruitment. That's part of our job. And if there's a staff person who's wrangling us to do that and it's their responsibility, then I think we won't go as long as we have gone with these vacancies. But it needs to be something that Nick, it needs to be something that somebody is in charge, is their responsibility on your staff, and that this is, you know, they got to do it.
Thank you, Director Kolb. I'm going to chime in briefly, and I see Director Haggerty and Aragin. I'll come back to you in a second. So I'm comfortable with the regional allocation. I think there's real logic to that. I'm comfortable with the current proposed seat allocation. I know that the South is, you know, should get 2.4 seats. But, you know, San Joaquin is really only has the population for half a seat. And so somebody's going to end up imperfect. And so the one thing I was thinking about, though, is that I like the idea of the alternates being by region. So we'd have the four regions with the allocation that's described, and then one alternate per region, presumably. I'm curious what my colleagues think about having one or two at-large seats that are not alternates, that are just appointed. That way, if we get a third person from, you know, Fremont or whatever it is, you know, that's really great, that we don't have to reject them because, oh, there's two other people already from that region. And so, sorry, you're gonna have to wait 6 years. And if we had a couple of at-large seats, it would provide a little bit of flexibility when we get an outstanding applicant. And that would bump up the total CAC from 9 to 11. So we're not booting anybody off. We're just adding a couple of additional opportunities. So I throw that out there for consideration. And I saw Director Aragin's hand up before I started. So go ahead, Director Aragin.
I think that's a good idea. Because then we can look at whoever is appointing. Then we can look at, you know, making sure that there is more regional balance. So I support that. A question for Nick in terms of sort of next steps. So we're going to make a recommendation. Then this will go to the full board in October to adopt the amendments.
Yes.
And then after we adopt it, then we'll start the application process.
I think we likely can sort of get the process moving before the final adoption.
Yeah, good. That's what I was going
to
ask.
I think the major point was we wanted to have this conversation because, you know, if we're really right now, for instance, in the northern zone, we already have three CAC members. So we would not be actively recruiting for more residents from the northern zone.
Yeah.
We would really be focusing on recruiting for the three open seats. And then perhaps if we add more seats, we'd really be focusing on recruiting Tri-Valley, Tri-Cities, and Tracy. So I think we probably can start that process, but I think we wanted to have at least some direction as to sort of whether or not this is the right process or not, because if it's not, and the view was no, we should have it be sort of no geography taken into account, then, you know, you might be marketing this or sharing this information in Oakland and Berkeley. And we just don't want residents there to get excited about joining a CAC and say, well, no, actually, you're not eligible.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. I mean, if we could start the process before board adoption, that's great. Cause I'm concerned about the current number of members on the CAC. And I think we've heard from them to, you know, need to jumpstart this process. So I think that'd be great. In terms of who should appoint, the mayor's conference does do a lot of regional appointments. Like we appoint to the Measure BB advisory committee and, you know, a lot of regional advisory committees. I think the benefit of this board doing it though, is we serve on this board. We understand the issues. We interact with the CAC. I think I think this board would have a better understanding about what we need on the CAC than the mayor's conference would, who may not. There is some overlap. Some members of the some mayors do serve on the EBC board, but not all of them. So I actually think having this board do is better because we're more informed about the board and about the issues. And could think more about the balance, the racial, gender, geographic, as well as just professional background and experience we want to bring to the CAC. So that leads me to my last question, which is the process. So the guidelines say that we would interview people or a ad hoc committee. The way we've done in the past is we've had an ad hoc committee that did the interviews and made nominations. So I think we need to kind of come to some agreement about what the process is so that, you know, once we get the applications, we can sort of launch that process. I don't know what the executive committee thinks, whether we're best suited to do that or creating an ad hoc committee.
Thank you, Director Ergin. I agree with everything you just said, by the way. Director Martinez.
I just wanted to lend my support to expanding the committee if we were to get enough applications. And I really hope to see that process go deep this time. So we do have the breadth of folks to pick from to really make sure that we have a diverse selection. And then I just wanted to ask staff if they have noticed an uptick or a downtick in public participation in the CAC meetings since they since shelter in place. So since we've gone online, and this is just something I brought up separately with Nick, is since it's not a Brown Act committee, if we can continue to have these meetings via Zoom, if that opens us up to more participation from the public and really gives a, just kind of levels the playing field, especially for those members of the public and potential committee members from San Joaquin to make sure that they're getting their voices heard. So I don't know if you've noticed, Nick, if more folks are attending, less folks are attending.
Yeah, I would say we're not seeing a significant change in the public participation. You know, maybe a few more listeners, but what I would say is we're seeing more regular participation from the CAC. So in the past, there had been some of our CAC members had, you know, had attendance issues because it's a Monday night. We were starting at 7. So for some, starting at 7 was late, so that it was hard. And then starting at 6 was hard to get there from work if you're commuting. So I think what we're finding is, one, meeting by Zoom allows for us to start the meeting earlier, which, you know, is beneficial because you're not going so late. And then two, I think particularly for our members who, you know, live in Fremont and then, you know, into the Tri-Valley and in San Joaquin, the Zoom was just going to make participation a lot easier. I think we've heard from candidates that that's sort of one of their main sort of reasons why they are kind of hesitant to join, is because, oh gosh, I have to drive to Hayward on Monday, deal with traffic. Obviously that's in the short run, that's not going to be an issue, but I do think that in the long run, it's probably a good practice. And it's something the CAC, even before COVID, had asked us about, is virtual participation. And, we certainly gained a lot more experience with facilitating these meetings now. So I think we feel very comfortable that we could support that.
Yes, and I think it would be more efficient for staff as well to take that commute time out.
Yep.
I'll just note on the question around the alternates and making those full members versus planning area alternates. I will say we have at times had with an alternate, one of the challenges just, am I joining the meeting, but am I participating? And then having someone who's sort of coming in, kind of not having followed a lot of the detail, can be a challenge. So I think perhaps the better approach, instead of maintaining alternates, is just to expand the body by two or even three members. And whether those are at large or allocated geographically, certainly I'm indifferent to that. But again, I think what we've observed is recruiting people to join the CAC as alternates is a little bit, again, we haven't tested it with Zoom too. So with Zoom, maybe it is easier, but I think having somebody a full member, it will be a more attractive proposition to join the CAC.
Director Martinez, any other, were you done? You're done, okay. Director Haggerty, and then I have a comment.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I do feel that we need alternates by planning area. I just don't see any other way to honestly do it. But, you know, this whole issue of the mayor's conference doing the appointment, look, maybe we should give the mayor's conference a couple appointments or something, or the at-large appointments. And the reason I say that is, you know, as elected officials, we are probably running the most important agency in Alameda County, right here. And I would be willing to bet you a third of the city council members have no idea who the hell we are. And by trying to get some city participation at a different level, because not all mayors go back, and not all city council members go back, and certainly not all supervisors go back and report out what we did at the EBCE meeting. And I'm just trying to find a way to get more people at the elected level involved with us. So A, when they do wind up getting appointed to us, you know, they know kind of what they're talking about. But B, I'm going to tell you, there's a huge campaign right now on Nextdoor where I live about the dumb people who ran their air conditioner all August and now wonder why their bill's so high. And they're blaming us, even though we're 1% cheaper. And I just think that it's really important that we have advocates and elected officials that can be out there helping us get the message out and the word out. So, I mean, I feel strongly about it, but I'm one vote. But I think we have an identity problem that at some point we need to start overcoming, and we have not overcame it. We have not. We're not working with all the local officials in Alameda County. We're just not getting there. So, you know, I think that it's important that, you know, and by the way, your numbers don't add up. They add up to 106%. So, and the 6% is probably Tracy, but you know, it, you know, everything else is 100 until you add Tracy and then you get to 106. So I just really am going to push hard. I think the planning area, the South planning area should get another one. I think we should have alternates for each one. And if you want at large, I think those should be mayor's conference appointments.
Okay. Thank you, Director Haggerty. So let me take a stab at pulling all this together and a motion for a recommendation. So I think I'll make this a motion so that we support staff's recommendation for the planning areas, including the CAC seat allocation, that we have one alternate for each area that would step in when there is a vacancy, not an absence, but a vacancy, that we add two at-large seats, expanding the CAC to 11 members, and that we let those two at-large seats be appointed by the mayor's conference. Is there a second for that?
Well, I'm not going to second it because you didn't give Fremont the South their extra seat.
Okay. No seconds, dies for lack of a second.
I apologize. I had to step away for a second. Could you repeat the motion? I apologize.
It is for the staff recommendation with the following changes. That instead of two alternates, there would be four, one for each planning area. That those alternates...
Tracy would have an alternate too.
You're right. Thank you for that. So that you're right. So there'd be five alternates, one for each of the five areas. That those alternates would be appointed when there is a vacancy, not an absence for an individual meeting, but a vacancy. That there be two at-large seats that are appointed by the mayor's conference. That's the motion.
And again, I'm sorry, I had an urgent thing step away. Does this indicate how many, and I apologize for forgetting what the staff recommendation was. Does this indicate how many appointments in each of the areas?
Yes, it includes the staff's recommendation for the seat allocation.
Oh, got it. Okay.
That's the motion.
Dan, I'm not seconding it because I really believe strongly that the South should get an extra seat. So if you don't have a second from that motion, I'll move that motion, but I'll add a third seat for the South.
So all right. So my motion died for lack of a second. There's a new one on the table, which is the same except for an additional seat for the South. And so are you adding then a 12th seat on the CAC to do that? Or are you taking it away from someone else?
No, I didn't take it from anybody.
Okay, so that'd be a 12th seat. So there'd be 12 seats total, 10 assigned by the geographic areas, two at large. Is that correct? Or do you want to take away one of the at larges to do it?
No, I don't want to take away anything. I just think that the South is so close to getting their third seat that they should get it.
So that's 12 total seats.
Okay, I'm not disagreeing with the math. I just haven't sat here and added it up.
Okay, so is there a second for that?
Six, 7, 10, 12. I'll second it.
So you just made the motion, Scott. Nice try.
No, you made it. You just read it back.
Scott, Supervisor Hagerty, that includes the two at-large seats as well?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'll second your motion for purposes of discussion.
Okay. Nick, I see you're... Nick, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Nick, and then I'll get to Director Martinez.
I just want to make sure that I understand when we're talking about the alternates, the implication, Al, because you've made a comment about the alternates being alternates in the case of a vacancy of the seat, not a missing meeting. Because right now what we've had is if somebody is not there, an alternate would actually step in and vote. But I think what we're saying here is that was not the case anymore. The alternate really is only if somebody steps down midterm, the alternate is the person who we would appoint. But as long as that seat is occupied, irrespective of whether someone's attending a meeting or not, the alternate would have no formal responsibilities within the CAC.
Is that the motion, Scott?
It's not really what I meant, but if staff wants, I just think that, you know, the problem with that is, you know, you're an alternate and you're just sitting there and you're getting nowhere. I don't see why we can't do a roll call 2 days before the meeting and say, are you coming? And say somebody from Central County says, no, I'm not. Then we call the alternate and say, you're up. And the alternate says, can't come in or can come in. Either way, and that's what happens.
I agree.
Okay.
I also think it's going to be hard to get people to be alternates if they're not going to be able to sit in when there's an absence. And moreover, for quorum purposes and for representation purposes, I think alternates should be allowed to participate if the voting CAC member is not going to participate.
And that's the policy we have right now. So actually, you don't need to say anything from a motion perspective. There would be no modification to the motion that needs to be made to effectuate that point, because that's exactly how the alternates operate today. But Al,
Okay. So Director Martinez, thank you for being patient. Go ahead.
Thank you. Now, I think the issue will be filling those alternate seats so we have someone to step in for each of those territories or parts of the territory. But Nick, I was hoping you'd be able to speak to the error on the voting share percentages as Director Hagerty astutely picked up on, they don't add up to 100%. So if we could get clarification on that, I think that will help me with who gets how many seats.
Well, it's probably my math error that as I was sort of adding up the various, it was a PDF. Let me see if I can pull up the spreadsheet.
Could you, if we give you 2 minutes, can you do
that? Yeah, I can do it in less than that.
We got the timer going.
Yeah.
It would be nice if we could just use math to solve this and rounding up and down as, you know, as my elementary age children are learning to do.
Just hold another minute here.
Oh, you guys are really gonna hold me to it, aren't you? Okay.
Well, if you want a little more time, go back to Director Hagerty. He's got his hand up again.
All right. I'm just trying to find the right spreadsheet.
Yeah. Okay. So the hands are all down. So yeah, we'll just wait for that. Okay. I mean, this is just a recommendation, so we could get this math cleared up between now and when the board takes formal action, if you like, but it'd be better to have it now if you can.
Yeah.
I kind of missed the issue on the math. The math works if you don't include Tracy. The minute you add Tracy is when it goes over 100%.
Right.
Tracy should be in there, though, is the thing. So
it makes me wonder if the math with Newark and Pleasanton was added in correctly as well, or if maybe we're running with some old numbers.
You know, I have it. Okay, I'm pulling it up right
now. Should have had his daughter do the math.
I know. You're right. All right, I have the JPA document open. I'm just going to the load share. So we have voting shares. We have Stephanie, could you pull it up just so unincorporated. So Berkeley is 5.5.
Well, while you're doing that, Nick, I'll just let the committee know that just to kind of test the process, I applied for the Sunrun solar survey, and I had a very good experience. I'm not going with it, but I had very good experience with customer service and talking through how much solar I could get on my roof and battery storage. And I just want to.
You know what the number, I think the issue was, I think we double counted in North. So North is actually, that's where the added 6% was.
So should we actually be 30% for
yeah,
North?
Yeah, if you think about North, Albany is 0.7, Berkeley is 5.5, Emeryville is 2.1, Piedmont is 0.3, and Oakland is 21.3. I think I may have double counted Berkeley. Sorry.
Berkeley's very special.
Yeah. Maybe that reflects mind share for, you know, but okay. That's where the double counting occurred.
Well, that gives
and they would
me,
still, sorry, I, go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry. That just gives me comfort in agreeing with Supervisor Haggerty that adding another person for South makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it gives me that comfort as well. So is staff clear on what the
my motion?
It was seconded by Aragin. So is staff clear on the instruction there? Any committee member need it repeated? I don't see anyone nodding their heads. Okay, then I'll call for the vote unless there's a final comment. Don't see anyone. So Stephanie, please call the vote.
Emeryville?
Aye.
Oakland?
Aye.
Alameda County?
Yes.
Berkeley?
Aye.
Hayward?
Yes.
Thank you. Motion passes unanimously.
All right. Thank
Mr.
you.
Chairman, I apologize. Yes. I have to drop off.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you stayed for this. That was very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Nice dog. I like the dog.
Okay, so moving on to our next item, the last major item for today. It is the item 6, Brilliant 100 Options for 2021. This is just an informational item, so there's no action to be taken. Nick, go ahead and provide the staff report, please.
Annie?
Nick, if it's okay?
Yeah. Yep, go ahead, Annie.
Yep. I'll go ahead and present this one. If we can go to the next slide, Stephanie, thanks. Maybe go back one. Okay, apologies. sorry, go ahead, Stephanie. So just a quick reiteration of what was presented at the board meeting a couple weeks ago. So
I think that's actually the next slide that you want, Annie, the second one maybe? For the third slide, Stephanie?
It's a mess, yeah.
Okay, so just, I'm sorry, never mind,
reiterating, no worries. I was reiterating what the discussion was at the last board meeting, and of course this is in response to discussion we had back in June about the cost implications of Brilliant 100 at the current 100% carbon-free cost parity with PG&E. So we presented to the board these three options of either increasing the cost of Brilliant 100 starting in 2021, 2 to 5% premium above PG&E, maybe closing it down. And then a third option was presented based on information that we received from member jurisdictions to look, requesting that we look into what a 100% carbon-free product at cost parity would be like if we accepted the nuclear allocation from PG&E. So next slide, please. There were three main questions that were discussed amongst the public and with the board. So how would a third product be presented in customer mailers, you know, primarily these compliance mailers that have to go out to all of our customers, the joint rate mailer, the power content label, which is a mailer. What would the cost be for the agency to actually subsidize Brilliant 100? And if a third product was approved and we didn't use all the nuclear allocation within that product, what would we do to manage that so that it didn't spill over into Bright Choice? Next slide, please. So just a quick update on the joint rate mailer and the power content label. To remind you, the joint rate mailer is something that we send out with PG&E. It's co-branded. The public advisor's office, which is an office within the CPUC, has to approve of it. To date, it's been either a postcard directly mailed to customers or an email. In 2020, we did a postcard with all three of EBCE's products. The email included only two products, and this was largely because PG&E has 16 CCAs within its territory, and they said, yes, we will send out your emails, but you have to use this template. So that was fine for a very large number of people who are served by Bright Choice and Brilliant 100. We would have liked to have the opportunity to present to them our Renewable 100 product, but what we were able to do is send all three products out in the postcard and just two in the email. And again, those limitations were set by PG&E, and I'll come back to that point later on. The power content mailer, this one is coming up. We need to send it out by the end of the year. It typically goes out by October 1, but there's been some movement in dates this year as the lead up reporting to this mailer has also been delayed. It is a very specific, the power content label itself that the CEC regulates is just that box. It's like the chart or nutritional label. But when we mail this out, what we did last year was the sort of large format postcard with a single fold. So all of the rest of the content is within our domain and within reason. So there is some additional marketing, real estate, and potential with that product. We do need to provide the same consistent nutritional label, you know, power content label to all customers. So it has to show all products that are available anywhere in the service territory. But elsewhere we can make some changes. So let's go ahead to the next slide, please. So I worked on a number of mock-ups, but this is just a reminder of what it looked like this year in postcard form. And this is for the joint rate mailer. So this is the less marketing oriented compliance mailer. Next slide, please. So what I then did was created a bunch of mock-ups of the joint rate mailer and the power content label, but I made some assumptions. So I just wanted to be clear on what I was presenting. So the scenarios that you're looking at assume that a third product was approved by the board and at least one jurisdiction is offering it. It assumes that the board agrees to each member agency being able to pick which products are available. It also assumes that the current Brilliant 100 product is closed and it's no longer offered to customers in 2021. So those were the assumptions I made as I went into mocking up what this might look like. Next slide, please. So the joint rate mailer did go out partly by email, and as I mentioned earlier, we could only include two products, but this is an example that was previous years. We could include the products available in each customer's jurisdiction. So we could customize this essentially for each city based on what products are available. Again, there's some additional assumptions here that EBCE sends out the emails because we already know that PG&E is not going to manage all this customization. And then it also assumes that this approach is approved by the public advisor's office. However, we already have that precedent established with this year having one version that was mailed and one version that was emailed. I think we can make a very good case that a customer should see the products that are available to them within their jurisdiction, only those, but all of those. Next slide, please. So did we skip one there, Stephanie, or did, okay, thank you. Just go one more forward. Perfect. So I'm referring to these two versions as a non-participating city, meaning this city has elected not to pick the third product that could, you know, would have the nuclear energy. And then a participating city is a city who elected to offer that to customers within their jurisdiction. So this is simply just a mock-up, but we could have a joint rate mailer version for the participate for a non-participating city, apologies, that would just show Bright Choice and Renewable 100. And then on the next slide, we would have all three products showing, and don't get attached to the numbers, I made those up, but you could have all three products showing for participating cities, and we could have these two versions mailed out to the appropriate customers. Next slide, please. So for the power content label, this is what it looked like last year when we sent it out. So you can see it's a lot more sort of a lot more graphic design and interesting, you know, design components to draw in a customer. So we can do a lot more here. If you can go to the next slide, this is the back of that folded postcard from last year. So this is the 2018 format that was sent out in 2019. The information within sort of that gray bolded box is what we can't change. But anything outside of that is what we can revise or augment or customize. So here I just proposed, and of course, we need to make the decision, you know, the board needs to make this decision. And then before these mailers went out, we would be working either with the marketing subcommittee or the appropriate representation of the board to make sure that we are representing this in a way that everyone is comfortable with. But what I've proposed here is, you know, we could just say third product is available only in X, Y, and Z, or not available, you know, depending on what the preference is. Next slide, please. Now, nothing in 2020 is straightforward, of course. And so there is a new power content label format. So what you see here is an example of what the new format is. So it's a little wider, and that is because in the upper left quadrant, you now have this graph that shows the greenhouse gas emissions intensity between various products. But again, the takeaway here is everything within that box needs to, you know, be approved by the CEC. We can still put something underneath it. In fact, we did last year, and that was just fine. Next slide, please. Now, this is the inside spread of the postcard. I just wanted to highlight that, you know, we can have additional messaging about the product or about the jurisdiction. And there's, you know, substantial space, I think, to relay that message. Next, please. And then additional options for the PCL. So we can have this additional information beyond the prescribed table. We can also use a different format if for some reason we felt that we needed more real estate for communicating information, or we wanted to focus in on something, we can do a different format. There's nothing prescribed from the Energy Commission on that. And we could have different versions. Again, the table itself has to be consistent amongst all versions, but we could have a participating version and a non-participating version that spoke to what was available in those communities. Next slide, please. So that addresses the first question, hopefully. The second question was about subsidizing Brilliant 100. We did look at this information, and there was a bunch of assumptions. Again, that went into coming up with a subsidy number of $3 million in 2021. And those assumptions are that the current base load does not change. So no new customers, no new communities, no load growth within that base. Any increase, of course, to the load growth is going to increase the cost to the agency. It also assumes that PG&E's rates do not decrease. So if they decrease, then that spread becomes larger and the $3 million goes up. And then lastly, that the PCIA does not increase. If that increases, then our generation rate is further compressed in order to hold parity with PG&E, and the cost to subsidize a Brilliant 100 product as it's currently offered would be even higher. And we do feel, I think, a fairly high degree of certainty that we're going to see the PCIA increase because it is being capped right now. And we know that we continue to build up sort of the debt that will trigger the cap to be removed, and the PCIA will go up. I think I have one more slide, one or two more. Next slide, please. And then the management of a potential nuclear allocation. So we don't know what an allocation would look like. In fact, you know, the PUC has not responded yet to PG&E's request to be able to offer this. They have until, well, PG&E asked them to respond by October 31st. But there are forecasts that are provided where we could take out the information and make some forecasts about what an allocation might be. And what we found was maybe about 700 gigawatt hours of large hydro, 1900 gigawatt hours of nuclear. If you just take the current load, again, no growth, no new communities, and we assume the 2021 RPS of 36% would leave us with a carbon-free appetite for this product of about 600 gigawatt hours. So we would have 1300 gigawatt hours of excess nuclear that would need to be dealt with. And the current approach is that, yes, we would need a third party to have an agreement in place that they would accept the excess allocation so that there was no reporting of nuclear clearly within Renewable 100 and not within the Bright Choice product. I believe that was my last slide.
You're muted, Al.
Thank you. Do any of my colleagues object to my taking public comment next? All right, I see everyone agreeing with that. So Stephanie, let's bring up the public comment speakers.
Okay, Jada, your microphone is unmuted.
Thank you, Stephanie. So I would like to start by sharing some information. Out of the 11 community choice program in the PG&E territory, 8 rejected the nuclear and only 3 accepted it. So 75% of the nuclear allotment that PG&E proposed was rejected. And then I would like to continue by saying that after the April meeting, when most of the EBC board members rejected nuclear, we were hoping that this issue won't come back again. And we started focusing on more urgent issues such as energy resiliency in our communities who are threatened by power shutoffs and rolling blackouts. But here we are again, talking about adding nuclear energy to EBC's energy portfolio. Nuclear has no future in accepting PG&E's nuclear allocation. To reduce your city's carbon emissions is a short-sighted solution to a problem that will continue to exist after Diablo Canyon shuts down in 2025. I would like to emphasize the need for the EBC staff to explore other possibilities if the cities are concerned about their GHG emissions. If there's an interest for an option that is cleaner than Bright Choice and cheaper than Renewable 100, then the staff should introduce all the possibilities, not just the one that would require EBC to accept the entire nuclear allocation. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Next speaker, Stephanie.
Cynthia Landry.
Yes, thank you. As previous stated, you know, the community has already spoken out strongly against nuclear energy. And I think that we would have to let the general public know that we are including the option of nuclear energy in the, you know, in the whole EBC area, regardless of whether the individual city opts into PG&E or not. I'm not clear if that's what the rate mailer would show or not, but I think we have to be cognizant that we can't, you know, hide that fact in a mailer or be a little too creative. And I see the cost approximately being $3 million if we were to subsidize Brilliant 100. And as I recall, at the last CAC and board meeting, we may, EBCE made another $20 million, if I'm correct, in profit that they were not necessarily expecting. So why don't we consider taking the $3 million to subsidize Brilliant 100 as a possibility, and therefore we can leave the nuclear energy out. The other thing, as everyone knows, is the board did agree for the large hydro addition. So, you know, if you know, that could be added, perhaps, you know, to backfill also. But I think we should, I really think that we should stay out of the, stay away from nuclear and energy, because while it's carbon free, in my mind, it's not totally clean. Thank you. So I would recommend, personally recommend looking at supplementing by $3 million versus adding nuclear. Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia. Next speaker.
Jessica Tovar.
Hi, Jessica Tovar, East Bay Clean Power Alliance. First off, I just want to remind folks that back in April, about 64 community members spoke and waited for 5 hours to demonstrate their crystal clear opposition to nuclear energy. And to consider this and to find ways to circumvent what the community has expressed really feels and really mirrors what the industry, the fossil fuel industry does, what PG&E does. East Bay Community Energy is not PG&E, and that is not what we wanted to see a local community choice program do. So I really think that you all should find other ways to meet the needs of your constituents without including nuclear, and come back with those proposals, because this really feels horrible on this end. And I have to emphasize the marketing, like, that's a nightmare to have to like cater to every city and have a different mix. That is a lot more work for your marketing team. On top of that, it really is conniving. This is really a dirty move, again, that mirrors the industry that has harmed so many people. We talked about the mining and the dumping and the transport of nuclear energy. Like, that stuff needs to end. Diablo Canyon is the last nuclear power plant in the state of California. San Onofre was abruptly shut down because of a crack in the facility, and it was leaking. This is a danger to our communities beyond the East Bay. And the decision that we make at East Bay Community Energy ripples throughout the United States and internationally. Are we going to support nuclear and keep it alive and ignore? We actually transition into clean energy and actually create a future that is sustainable. We're at a crossroads. Y'all seen the smoke? Y'all seen the fires? If you're serious about a climate emergency, the only form of energy is actually clean energy that we need. And the only bridge energy really right now is the remote energy that you have contracted. But it's time we start building it here at home so that we create jobs and the sustainability we need for our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica. Next speaker. Stephanie, do we have the next speaker?
Hello? I think it's me, Barbara.
Yes, Barbara, go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. So I want to start off by saying I think Annie Henderson needs an apology for being asked to turn a sow's ear into a silk purse. Basically, from our perspective and the perspective of the community organizations that support us in the advocacy that we do, this is a redo of a decision that the board made in April not to accept nuclear energy. There's no way you can spin this that doesn't make it that somehow would turn it into something it isn't. And what it is it would be EBCE accepting an allotment of nuclear. And how they're going to use it, that is almost beside the point. So we heard a lot of board members want a third option. So I'll echo what Cynthia Landry said, that not only did the board make apparently like over $60 million in net, the net profit in 2019-2020, but it looks like there'll be $22 million additional added to that that wasn't foreseen. Let's take some of that additional net, subsidize Brilliant 100 without creating huge community controversy, a nightmare in terms of marketing. This agency, which needs to distinguish itself from PG&E. And the last point I really want to make is that accepting nuclear energy from Diablo Canyon does nothing to address local emissions. The emissions that are happening in Hayward locally will remain the same. It also does nothing to reduce emissions in California because that energy is already on the grid in California. What it will do is it will keep EBCE from procuring additional carbon-free energy to meet the requirements of Brilliant 100. So actually, it will result in a slight increase in emissions overall in the state of California. So those are some of the main points. There are many other main points that I just want you to understand. People are gearing up to come speak in October to tell you once again, we do not want nuclear in our local public electric agency. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Next speaker, Stephanie.
Ingor Trigo.
Thank you very much. So actually the last few speakers hit on all the points that I would have provided. So I just wanted to double click on and emphasize everything that has just been said from the public. in addition to that, if it is such an issue to figure out what the future of bike choice is, then I would suggest that maybe we phase out bike choice, because it's a lot easier to market two options and then ensure that the baseline option continues to be 1% discounted compared to PG&E rates, while it continues to increase its renewable content, which would help achieve the overall end goal of all CCAs, which is to achieve 100% renewable energy at a lower cost than IOUs. Thanks for this opportunity to comment, and I hope that these public comments will be taken seriously by board members and staff.
Thank you, Igor. Looks like our last person with their hand up is Blair Beekman.
Hey, Blair Beekman.
Thank you. There seems to be a parallel existence going on with the future of EBCE and nuclear power, and what I feel allows for the ideas of bait and switch, and that can shortchange the expectations of the everyday public. I hope that this can be a time to ask a few questions about things. After all, was said and done at the informative BOD meeting last Wednesday, it sounds like the EBCE will be asking for the usual amount of about 20% nuclear that most local Bay Area communities have been asking for with their energy for the past several years now. We should be able to return to our more familiar routines of post-COVID-19 by 2022, I feel. Can we begin now, and how to begin to steadily distance ourselves from nuclear power, and that we can develop a clear picture and understanding together how nuclear power energy use can be cut in incremental steps of about 2% each year for about the next 10 years. I feel it's an important way to bargain, negotiate, and have dialogue to begin a clear direction how to talk about the future local use of nuclear energy by the EBCE and the community. This sort of thinking is respectful to everyone and the years of East Bay local community energy study practices. Both COVID-19 and nuclear power have a high price for their learning experience and promises to build a more sustainable future for humankind. As both COVID-19 and nuclear energy are a part of the same think tank mentality that can simply allow for acceptable losses of mass numbers of people in the long-term social planning for a society. The ideas of care, love, day-to-day communication, continual negotiation and dialogue, these are the ideas of how government works at the local level. And these are the lessons that have to be learned at the national level as well. I don't think anyone at the local level likes the term acceptable losses and tends to consider long-term societal plans and goals that don't have to harm the everyday people of their local communities. I feel these are the ways to define a more genuine, positive, long-term human and community sustainability, and exactly what renewable energy and local community energy try to always work towards. I hope it is these sorts of thoughts and ideas that will be discussed these next few weeks and this fall with bright and brilliant energy plans. And from this, a good luck in the decision-making of local East Bay communities and how they will address the issue of nuclear energy in 2021 and onward. Thank you. With my remaining time, 30 seconds, PG&E simply wants to learn the incredibly important lessons that can be taught by local community energy. I mean, there's an incredible promise of what local community energy can do. And for PG&E and COVID-19 and, you know, this country to work towards shock doctrine practices to continue those things is just ridiculous in the love and beauty we're basically trying to work on for decades now.
Thank you. Thank you, Blair.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to everyone for your constructive comments. I do appreciate them. So to my colleagues on the committee, anyone want to raise their hand and chime in on this? Okay, Nick, I see you raising your hand. Thank you. You're muted, Nick.
One point that was not raised in Annie's presentation, because it was not about the presentation of how this would be seen by the customers, but I think it's just from a timing perspective. You know, as we at staff been thinking about the timeline for decision making, I think our current thinking is to actually bifurcate the decisions. So in October, deal with the question of Brilliant 100, whether to offer it as a premium next year or whether or not to offer it next year, and then move the question of whether or not to allow for the creation of this new product that would be kind of opt-in for cities to November. So I just wanted to share that. That's our current thinking, and you know, sort of put that out there for comment and feedback from the board as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chassett. So I see that Director Martinez has her hand up. Go ahead.
Thank you. So Nick, we would still have the option of also closing the product to new customers, but keeping the accounts that are currently assigned.
Yeah. That was not in the sort of initial staff presentation as an option, but certainly that is an option.
Because if we can, you know, if that 3 million delta is acceptable to the board, if we could kind of have a handle on it and make sure that, you know, it's not going to explode with new enrollments into that product, you know, I think that this, you know, the idea of nuclear is obviously a third rail for the agency, and it's a difficult decision, but I think an in-between answer could be to digest this subsidy and cap the product.
Thank you. Anyone else wanna chime in?
No, that's part of the reason why I asked for the analysis, which was included in the presentation, about what would the added cost be to the agency if we were to subsidize the current the current accounts under Boeing 100. I think if we were to do that, I agree. I think we should close the product, because that would just be even more added cost to the agency. One thing I did talk to Mr. Chassett about around this whole proposal is you know, long term, sort of looking at how we the options that we're providing with Bright Choice and with Renewable 100. And looking at how we can increase the GHG free content in Bright Choice. And I know that Mr. Chassett's talked about the idea of a local development option for Renewable 100, meaning that, you know, accounts or cities would basically buy into a solar or wind project and would have fixed costing over a certain period of time as a way to help fund that project. And it supports local development in the area and would ensure some fixed rates to the ratepayers. So anyways, I'm particularly interested in what other options we can explore to increase the GHG content in these other products that we're providing. I know with the integrated resource plan process that provides a kind of an opportunity to have that conversation around what in the short term and long term that could look like. So Mr. Chassett, is the idea still that we would make a decision on Brilliant 100 in October and then address the issue of the third product in November?
That would be the current that is my current thinking from a sort of phasing perspective.
Yeah.
To deal with Brilliant 100 in October, and then the question of the allocation, the nuclear allocation in particular in November, and you know, obviously the nuclear allocation really in the context of city specific opt-in. I think just sort of following up on your point around local renewables. So we have talked about a third product where customers could basically sign up for the output of a local renewable project. and, you know, kind of get a fixed price. I think one other idea that we've been thinking about along those lines is taking the output from our Altamont Wind project and allocating that to Renewable 100, recognizing that, you know, there's a certain threshold at which new participation in, say, Renewable 100, we could no longer guarantee that it comes from our local renewable project until such time as we have more. But at the current levels of participation in Renewable 100, and even that, you know, not an insignificant growth, we could allocate our wind energy output to those customers so that those customers are not just 100% renewable, but that 100% local renewable. And there would be no cost premium relative to Renewable 100. They would pay the same as they're currently paying on Renewable 100, but they're getting, it's even more attractive because it's 100% local renewables.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director Aragin. I'm gonna comment unless Director Cobb waves at me. Okay, so I'll go ahead. So I think, you know, for me, and I do believe I'm speaking for the Hayward Council and even the Hayward community when I say this, that what we really want is a greenhouse gas-free option where we aren't paying, you know, some huge premium over PG&E. That's what we want. I know there have been requests for, like, different ways of providing that and solving it, and believe me, I have been bothering the heck out of our CEO for a number of months now, exploring options, trying to come up with some way to do this. And the only two that I'm aware of are the two that have been discussed today. One is accepting the nuclear allocation, which allows it to be greenhouse gas free without increasing the cost. And so we can keep it at parity with PG&E. Or having EBCE subsidize the Brilliant 100 customers. Now, I have not felt comfortable asking for that for, you know, it feels a little, you know, I don't know that it's sustainable long-term. I don't feel comfortable asking for that. But if you know, the other cities feel strongly enough about nuclear, they're willing to subsidize the choice that Hayward wants to make, which is to have a greenhouse gas-free product that doesn't cost 2 or 5 or 8 or 10% more than PG&E, which my relatively poor community cannot afford, then I can live with that. I don't know how sustainable it is, but I can live with it because for me, this is all about, and I think, I believe I'm speaking for my colleagues and my community. This is about combating climate change. And that means a greenhouse gas-free product that is affordable. So, you know, if there's a second way to do that, I'm open to it. There are only two wrinkles to that that I would encourage my colleagues to think about. One is that this isn't just about Hayward and Albany that have the product now. I think we heard Pleasanton and Newark say that they would like to be able to offer that as an option to their customers, maybe even select it as a default. And so while they are not here, I think it's important to remember that we need to be thinking about how to provide them with a solution that works for them. And the second point that I have not raised before, because I've been afraid of complicating this, is that, you know, Hayward has 25% of its accounts on Bright Choice, which in the past was acceptable. Those were the CARES Act, the discounted rate customers. We were trying to maximize the savings for them. And when Bright Choice was at most 15% natural gas, that was an acceptable option for Hayward. It is now 40% natural gas, which is higher than PG&E. I'm very sorry to have to say that. And so that, you know, I've been wondering if we would want to put all of our users onto Brilliant 100. I get that complicates things, and I'm really not trying to do it. I'm just trying to provide my community with a greenhouse gas-free option or a very low greenhouse gas option that EBC no longer offers except for Brilliant 100 and Renewable 100. So That's where I stand. I'll leave it at that. And I see Director Martinez raising her hand again. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your comments, Chair. This is a complicated decision for me because I don't believe that taking the nuclear allocation brings us any closer to Diablo Canyon closing any sooner than it actually is going to close. And I don't believe that nuclear is the future. So I think that if we accepted a nuclear allocation, it's a stopgap solution for the short term. But I also think that if we were to, the $3 million subsidy is a lot smaller than I expected it to be, frankly. And I, that's a short-term solution as well. This is a topic that we will have to come to continuously, but I will say that hearing the number, it doesn't trouble me. And I think that it should be on the table for the full board to consider for the next year, because I don't know that people are, you know, there may be folks who are like me who are very much on the fence because they can see the benefits of both. But I was just going over the budget that we just passed in June, and this doesn't take a huge knock into it.
Okay. Thank you, Director Martinez. Director Aragon, your hand is up again.
Yeah, just following up on your comments on Bright Choice. I mean, I just think whatever the decision is of the board on this issue, and I've expressed my opinions on this at our last board meeting, expressing my concern about giving cities the option to accept nuclear and it appearing on the power content label. And regardless of all that, I do think we need to think about how we are increasing the GHG content of Bright Choice in the long term. So I just want to make that statement. I think that should be a sort of a near-term goal that we set.
Yeah, I completely agree. Thank you for that. Director Kalb. We can hear you.
So I guess we're not going to get some hamsters to run on a circle wheel. Probably that's not going to be a solution. So we'll rule that out. I don't have any great answers here. It is appropriate, of course, for the full board to make this decision. So we're not making a decision today. Nick, could you again reiterate what was, you said you're going to bifurcate a decision. Can you repeat that again? I missed that.
Yes. So our current plan is to take action on Brilliant 100, whether or not. So I think now, based on the feedback, it would be there's three options to close Brilliant 100 altogether. So starting January 1, 2021, that rate is not an option anymore. So customers that are on that rate would need to be moved to Renewable 100 or Bright Choice. Option two is to maintain Brilliant 100, but at a 2 to 5% cost premium. And then that rate would be available to all EBC customers. And I think now option three would be right now we have Brilliant 100. It's no new customers can sign up for it, but if you are a customer that has been on Brilliant 100, you're continuing to stay. Option three would be to keep that practice in place through 2021, recognizing that it would have a budget of impact of around $3 million. So it would increase our procurement costs by around $3 million while not, relative to the amount of revenue that we're generating. So the implication there being Hayward, Albany, and then mostly municipal accounts around the territory would be able to continue, but no new accounts, and then our new communities would not be eligible for Brilliant 100 either. So that would be the action we would be taking in October. And then in November, we would consider the idea of creating a new product where we accept the nuclear allocation and then it is allocated only to customers in communities where the city council has voted to accept nuclear, and that product would be priced at parity with PG&E rates.
Okay,
But that would happen, I think, in the third Wednesday in November.
And in those cities, if there were cities that did that, if there were city councils to vote in those cities, those customers would have to accept nuclear if they want to do a brilliant 100. They could not do that.
No, not necessarily. So it would sort of depend on the action the board takes. So if the board were to say maintain brilliant 100, but limit it to say it's not open to any new customers. Okay. So, and then let's say the city of Pleasanton still says, well, we want a carbon-free option that's priced at parity with PG&E. The board would need to determine in November whether or not to create a fourth product that is carbon-free, but includes nuclear, and as a result of it including nuclear, is priced at parity with PG&E rates. But that product would only be only customers in, say, the city of Pleasanton or any city that votes to allow nuclear would be eligible for that particular product. Every, you know, all other communities, they would be limited to Bright Choice and, say, Renewable 100, or if they're a customer that is already on Brilliant 100, they would have three choices.
Okay, I understand.
Thank you, Director Kolb. So let me, you were done, yes? Yeah, okay. Sorry about that. So let me just follow up on that for just a second. Nick, correct me if I'm wrong, but if the decision in October is to maintain Brilliant 100 at parity with PG&E and just subsidize it for, let's say, a year, then the November conversation doesn't need to take place.
Well, I think the...
Yes, no?
The city of Pleasanton has requested, and so they would not be eligible for Brilliant 100 because...
Okay, I got it. That makes sense. So here's maybe a compromise that might work. So again, let's say in October we decide to keep Brilliant 100 at parity. We subsidize it. We say that no cities can newly choose it as a default for, you know, a massive amount of customers. But the three new jurisdictions could offer it as an opt-up, so that their customers have the choice of it. And we know from experience that what's likely to happen is that we get 1 or 2% of their load choosing that as an opt-up, but 100% of their customers have it as a choice. And that might be a compromise that would seem fair to Pleasanton and Newark. Without breaking the bank, you know, because you're talking about, you know, maybe $10,000 of additional, $20,000 of additional subsidy, not a massive amount. All right. So Nick, looks like you want to respond to that, and then Director Martinez.
Director Martinez, why don't you go?
Director Martinez first.
I think that actually makes a lot of sense to me because in the cases of Pleasanton and Newark, they were late coming on board because they were cautious about how we would go, and they have been very cognizant about the three products that we currently offer, and that's how they've been talking to their constituents. That's how they've been communicating this with their communities. So that makes a lot of sense to me, and I'd like to see those numbers of opt-ups historically that we've had included in the information brought back to the full board. I think that will help. And I apologize, I have someone at my door, so I need to go. But that makes sense to me, Al. Thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you, Director Martinez. Nick, did you want to follow up?
Yeah, we will prepare that as an option. I think that the consideration is really, I think we get to sort of an expectation setting that, you know, we're subsidizing for a year, but what happens in the future when we decide we're unable to subsidize the rate anymore? And so I think part of the rationale, either sort of we either accept that it's more expensive or we accept that it's not a product, is we're going to run into the same issue year after year after year if the costs are higher than the revenue. And I certainly for 1 year we can support it, maybe two, but at a certain point there's going to be a question of, well, do we And frankly, the longer you stay with that, the more customers become accustomed to this idea that they have this product available to them. I think in a way, especially if we're talking about like the fit into a climate action plan, we're sort of doing your climate action plan a disservice by giving you sort of a 1 year benefit, because you're setting a climate action plan assuming, oh, we have Brilliant 100 in place, but we don't have a financially sustainable Brilliant 100.
I acknowledge the complications. I do. And so I think that if that is the decision that the board ends up making, I think there is an implicit acknowledgement that that conversation is probably going to have to, I'm sorry to say this, but the conversation is probably going to have to be, you know, sort of had every year. Do we continue subsidizing it, or do we look at other options? And as I've said, the only other option available is the one that, you know, we've been talking about so much. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to drop off, which means we're going to lose a quorum. I apologize, but I'm.
That's okay. So, we can end the discussion, but I do want just one comment. Thank you all for engaging in this. This is to the members of the public, the members of the committee, and members of staff. This is a complicated issue and one with no perfect answers, but I really appreciate everyone engaging in this and considering it and having an open mind. So thank you all for that. All right, with that, I'm gonna close this item and very quickly ask if there are any committee member and staff announcements that just cannot wait. All right. Thank you for hanging in there, everyone. I know we went a little over. This meeting is adjourned.